knew you were going to throw up? The doctor made a gesture like, well, sure. But that's just in your stomach, Kate Gompert said. It's a horrible feeling, but it's just in your stomach. That's why the term is sick to your stomach. She was back to looking intently at her lower carpa petals. What I told Dr. Garten is okay, but imagine if you felt that way all over inside. All through you. Like every cell and every atom or brain cell or whatever was so nauseous it wanted to throw up, but it couldn't. And you felt that way all the time. And you're sure, you're positive, the feeling will never go away. You're going to spend the rest of your natural life feeling like this. The doctor wrote down something much too brief to correspond directly to what she'd said. He was nodding both while he wrote and when he looked up.
And yet this nauseated feeling has come and gone for you in the past. It's passed eventually during prior depressions, Catherine, has it not?
But when you're in the feeling, you forget. The feeling feels like it's always been there and will always be there, and you forget. It's like this whole filter drops down over the whole way you think about everything. A couple of weeks after... They sat and looked at each other. The doctor felt some combination of intense clinical excitement and anxiety about perhaps saying the wrong thing at such a crucial juncture and fouling up. His last name was needle-pointed in yellow braid on the left breast of the white coat he was required to wear.
I'm sorry, a couple of weeks after...
He waited for 7 breaths. I want shock, she said finally. Isn't part of this whole concerned kindness deal that you're supposed to ask me how I think you can be of help? Because I've been through this before. You haven't asked me what I want, isn't it? Well, how about either you give me ECT again, or give me my belt back? Because I can't stand feeling like this another second, and the seconds keep coming on and on.
29.
Well, the doctor said slowly, nodding to indicate he had heard the feelings the young woman was expressing. Well, I'm happy to discuss treatment options with you, Catherine, but I have to say right now I'm curious about what you started, it sounded like to me, to maybe start to indicate what might have occurred, something, 2 weeks ago to make you feel these feelings now. Would you be comfortable talking to me about it?
Either ECT or you could just sedate me for a month. You could do that. All I'd need is, I think, a month at the outside. Like a controlled coma. You could do that if you guys want to help.
The doctor gazed at her with the patience she was meant to see.
And she gave him back a frightening smile. A smile empty of all effect. As if someone had contracted her circumorals with a thigmotactic electrode.
The teeth of the smile evidenced a clinical depressive's classic inattention to oral hygiene.
She said, I was thinking I was about to say, you'll think I'm crazy if I tell you. But then I remembered where I am.
She made a small sound that was supposed to be laughter. It did sound jagged, dentate.
I was going to say I've thought sometimes before, like, the feeling maybe had to do with hope.
Hope. Her arms had been crossed over her breasts the whole time, and though the room was overheated, the patient rubbed each palm continually over her upper arms, behavior one associates with chill. The position and movement shielded her inner arms from view. The doctor's eyebrows had gone synclinal from puzzlement without his awareness.
Bob.
Bob. The doctor was anxious that his failure to have any idea what the girl was referring to would betray itself and accentuate her feelings of loneliness and psychic pain. Classic unipolars were usually tormented by the conviction that no one else could hear or understand them when they tried to communicate. Hence jokes, sarcasm, the psychopathology of unconscious arm rubbing. Kate Gompert's head was rolling like a blind person's.
Jesus, what am I doing here? Bob Hope. Dope. Sense, stick, grass, smoke.
She made a quick Dubois gesture with thumb and finger held to rounded lips.
The dealers down where I buy it, some of them make you call it Bob Hope when you call, in case anybody's accessed the line.
You're supposed to ask, is Bob in town? And if they have some, they say, hope springs eternal. Usually. It's like a code. One kid makes you ask him to please commit a crime. The dealers that stay around any length of time tend to be on the paranoid side. As if it would fool anybody who knew enough to bother to access the band on the call. She seemed decidedly more animated. And one particular guy with snakes in a tank in a trailer in Alston, he...
So drugs, then, you're saying you feel may be a factor,
the doctor interrupted. The depressed young woman's face emptied once more. She engaged briefly in something the staffers on specials called the 1,000-meter stare. Not drugs, she said slowly. The doctor smelled shame in the room, sour and uremic. Her face had become distantly pained now. The girl said, stopping. The doctor felt comfortable saying once again that he was not sure he understood what she was trying to share with him. She now went through a series of expressions that made it clinically possible for the doctor to determine whether or not she was entirely sincere. She looked either pained or trying somehow to suppress hilarity. She said, I don't know if you'll believe me. I'm worried you'll think I'm crazy. I have this thing with pot.
Meaning marijuana.
The doctor was oddly sure that Kate Gompert pretended to sniff instead of engaging in a real sniff.
Marijuana. Most people think of marijuana as just some minor substance. I know, just like this natural plant that happens to make you feel good the way poison oak makes you itch. And if you say you're in trouble with hope, people will just laugh. Because there's much worse drugs out there. Believe me, I know.
I'm not laughing at you, Catherine,
the doctor said, and meant it.
But I love it so much. Sometimes it's like the center of my life. It does something to me. I know, that's not good, and I got told point blank not to smoke on the Parnate because Dr. Garden said no one knew what certain combinations do yet and it'd be roulette. But after a while, I always think to myself it's been a while and things will be different somehow this time if I do, even on the Parnate. So I do again. I start again. I'll start out doing just like a couple of hits off of Dubois after work to get me through dinner, because dinner with my mother and me is, well, but, and pretty soon after a while, I'm in my room with the fan pointed at the window all night, doing one-hitters and exhaling at the fan to kill the smell. And I make her say I'm not there if anybody calls, and I lie about what I'm doing in there all night, even if she doesn't ask. Sometimes she asks, and sometimes she doesn't. And then after a while, I'm smoking joints at work, at breaks, going in the bathroom and standing on the toilet and blowing it out the window. There's this tiny window up high with the glass frosted and all filthy and cobwebby, and I hate having my face up next to it, but if I clean it off, I'm afraid Mrs. Diggs or somebody will be able to tell somebody's been doing something up around the window, standing there in high heels on the rim of the toilet, brushing my teeth all the time, and using up collyrium by the bottleful and switching the console to audio, and always needing more water before I answer the console because my mouth's too dry to talk, especially on the Parnate. The Parnate makes my mouth dry anyways.
30.
And pretty soon, I'm totally paranoid. They know I'm stoned at work, sitting there in the office, high, reeking, and I'm the only one that can't tell I reek. I'm like so obsessed with, do they know? Can they tell? And then after a while, I'm having my mother call in sick for me so I can stay home after she goes in to work and have the whole place to myself with nobody to worry about. Do they know? And smoke out the fan and spray Lysol all over and stir Ginger's little box around so the whole place reeks of ginger and smoke and draw and watch terrible daytime stuff on the TP because I don't want my mother to see any cartridge orders on days I'm supposed to be in bed sick. I start to get obsessed with, does she know? I'm getting more and more miserable and fed up with myself for smoking so much. This is after a couple of weeks of it, is all. And I start getting high and thinking about nothing except how I have to quit smoking all this Bob so I can get back to work and start saying I'm here when people call so I can start living some kind of a damn life instead of just sitting around in pajamas pretending I'm sick like a third grader and smoking and watching TP again. And so after I've smoked the last of whatever I've got, I always say, no more, this is it. And I throw out my papers and my one-hitter. I've probably thrown about 50 one-hitters in dumpsters, including some nice wood and brass ones, including a couple from Brazil.
The land barge guys must go through our sector's dumpsters once a day, looking to get another good one-hitter.
And anyways, I quit. I do stop. I get sick of it. I don't like what it does to me. And I go back to work and work my fanny off to make up for the last couple weeks and get a leg up on, like, building momentum for a whole new start, you know?
The young woman's face and eyes were going through a number of ranges of affective configurations, with all of them seeming inexplicably at gut level somehow blank and maybe not entirely sincere.
And so, she said, but then I quit. And a couple of weeks after I've smoked a lot and finally stopped and quit and gone back to really living, after a couple of weeks, this feeling always starts creeping in, just creeping in a little at the edges at first. Like first thing in the morning when I get up, or waiting for the tea to go home, after work, for supper. And I try to deny it, the feeling, ignore it, because I fear it more than anything.
The feeling you're describing that starts creeping in.
Kate Gompert finally took a real breath.
And then, but no matter what I do, it gets worse and worse. It's there more and more. This filter drops down. The feeling makes the fear of the feeling way worse. And after a couple weeks, it's there all the time, the feeling, and I'm totally inside it. I'm in it. And everything has to pass through it to get in. And I don't want to smoke any Bob, and I don't want to work, or go out, or read, or watch TP, or go out, or stay in, or either do anything or not do anything. I don't want anything except for the feeling to go away. But it doesn't. Part of the feeling is being, like, willing to do anything to make it go away. Understand that? Anything? Do you understand? It's not wanting to hurt myself. It's wanting to not hurt.
The doctor hadn't even pretended to try to take notes on all this. He couldn't keep himself from trying to determine whether the ambient blank insincerity the patient seemed to project during what appeared, clinically, to be a significant gamble, had moved toward trust and self-revealing was, in fact, projected by the patient or was somehow counter-transferred or projected onto the patient from the doctor's own psyche, out of some sort of anxiety over the critical therapeutic possibilities her revelation of concern over drug use might represent. The time this thinking required looked like sober and thoughtful consideration of what Kate Gompert said. She was again gazing at her feet's interactions with the empty boating sneakers, her face moving between expressions associated with grief and suffering. None of the clinical literature the doctor had read for his psych rotation suggested any relation between unipolar episodes and withdrawal from cannabinoids.
So this has happened in the past, prior to your other hospitalizations then, Catherine?
Her face, foreshortened by its downward angle, was working in the spread. Writhing configurations of weeping, but no tears emerged.
I just want you to shock me. Just get me out of this. I'll do anything you want.
Have you explored this possible connection between your cannabis use and your depressions with your regular therapist, Catherine?
She did not respond directly as such. Her associations began to loosen, in the doctor's opinion, as her face continued to work dryly.
I had shock before, and it got me out of this. Straps, nurses with their sneakers and little green bags, anti-saliva injections, rubber thing for your tongue, general. Just some headaches. I didn't mind it at all. I know everybody thinks it's horrible. That old cartridge, Nichols and the big Indian, distortion. They give you a general here, right? They put you under. It's not that bad. I'll go, willingly.
The doctor was summarizing her choice of treatment option, as was her right, on her chart. He had extremely good penmanship for a doctor. He put her, "Get me out of this," in quotation marks. He was adding his own post-assessment question, "Then what?" when Kate Gompert began weeping For real. And just before 0145 hours, on the 2nd of April, YDAU, his wife arrived back home and uncovered her hair and came in and saw the Near Eastern medical attaché and his face and tray and eyes and the soiled condition of his special recliner, and rushed to his side, crying his name aloud, touching his head, trying to get a response, failing to get any response to her, he still staring straight ahead. And eventually, and naturally, she, noting that the expression on his rictus of a face nevertheless appeared very positive, ecstatic even, you could say, she, eventually and naturally, turning her head and following his line of sight to the cartridge viewer. Gerhard Stitt, head coach and athletic director at the Enfield Tennis Academy, Enfield, Massachusetts, was wooed fiercely by ETA headmaster Dr. James Incandenza, just about begged to come on board the moment the academy's hilltop was shaved flat and the place was up and running. Incandenza had decided he was going to bring Stitt on board or bust. This, even though Stitt had then just lately been asked to resign from the staff of a Nick Bollettieri camp in Sarasota because of a really unfortunate incident involving a riding crop. By now, though, pretty much everyone now at ETA feels as though stories about Stitt's whole corporal punitive thing must have been pumped up out of all sane proportion, because even though Stitt still does favor those high and shiny black boots, and yes, the epaulettes still, and now a weatherman's telescoping pointer that's a clear stand-in for the now-forbidden old riding crop, he has, Stitt, at near what must be 70, mellowed to the sort of elder statesman point where he's become mostly a dispenser of abstractions rather than discipline, a philosopher instead of a king. His felt presence is here mostly verbal. The weatherman's pointer has not made corrective contact with even one athletic bottom in Stitt's whole 9 years at ETA. Still, although he now has all these Lebengefahrtens and prorectors to administer most of the necessary little character-building cruelties, Stitt does like his occasional bit of fun still.
31.
So, but when Stitt dons the leather helmet and goggles and revs up the old FRG-era BMW cycle and trails the sweating ETA squads up the Commonwealth Avenue hills into East Newton on their PM conditioning runs, making judicious use of his pea shooter to discourage straggling sluggards, it's usually 18-year-old Mario Incandenza who gets to ride along in the sidecar, carefully braced and strapped, the wind blowing his thin hair straight back off his oversized head, beaming and waving his claw at people he knows. It's possibly odd that the leptosomatic Mario I, so damaged he can't even grip a stick, much less flail at a moving ball with one, is the one kid at ETA whose company Stitt seeks out, is in fact pretty much the one person with whom Stitt speaks candidly, lets his pedagogical hair down. He's not close to his prorectors, particularly, Stitt, and treats Aubrey DeLint and Mary Esther Thode with a formality that's almost parodic. But often of a warm evening, sometimes Mario and Coach Stitt will find themselves out alone under the East Court's canvas pavilion or the towering copper beach west of Com Ad, or at one of the initial scarred redwood picnic tables off the path out behind the headmaster's house where Mario's mother and uncle live, Stitt savoring a postprandial pipe, Mario enjoying the smells of the calliopsis alongside the ground's quincunx paths, the Swedish pines, and the briar's yeasty musk coming up from the hillside slopes. And he actually likes the sulfury odor of Stitt's obscure Austrian blend. Stitt talks, Mario listens, generally. Mario is basically a born listener. One of the positives to being visibly damaged is that people can sometimes forget you're there, even when they're interfacing with you. You almost get to eavesdrop. It's almost like they're like, if nobody's really in there, there's nothing to be shy about. That's why bullshit often tends to drop away around damaged listeners, deep beliefs revealed, diary-type private reveries indulged out loud, and, listening, the beaming and Brady-kinetic boy gets to forge an interpersonal connection he knows only he can truly feel here. Stitt has the sort of creepy wiriness of old men who still exercise vigorously. He has surprised blue eyes and a vivid white crew cut of the sort that looks virile and good on men who have lost a lot of hair anyway. And skin so clean, sheet white it almost glows, an evident immunity to the sun's UV. In pine-shaded twilight, he is almost glowingly white, as if cut from the stuff of moons. He has a way of focusing his whole self's concentration very narrowly, adjusting his legs spread for the varicoceles and curling one arm over the other and sort of drawing himself in around the pipe he attends to. Mario can sit motionless for really long periods. When Stitt exhales pipe smoke in different geometric shapes, they both seem to study intently. When Stitt exhales, he makes little sounds variant in plosivity between P and B.
I'm realizing whole myth of efficiency and no waste that is making this continent of countries we are in.
He exhales.
You know, myths?
Is that like a story?
Ach, a made-up story. For some children. An efficiency of Euclid only. Flat. For flat children. Straight ahead, plow ahead, go! This is myth.
There aren't any flat children, really.
This myth of the competition and the bestness we fight for you players here. This myth.
They assume here always the efficient way is to plow in straight. Go.
The story that the shortest way between two places is the straight line, yes?
Yes? Stitt can use the stem of the pipe to point for emphasis.
But what then? When something is in the way. When you go between places, no? Plow ahead, go, collide, kabong!
Willikers!
Where is their straight shortest den, yes? Where is the efficiently quickly straight of Euclid den, yes? And how many two places are there without there is something in the way between them, if you go?
It can be entertaining to watch the evening pines mosquitoes light and feed deeply on luminous Stitt, who is oblivious. The smoke doesn't keep them away.
When I am boyish, training to compete for best, our training facilities on a sign very largely painted stated, we are what we walk between.
Gosh. It's a tradition, one stemming maybe from Wimbledon's All England Locker Rooms Timpana, that every big-time tennis academy has its own special traditional motto on the wall in the locker rooms, some special aphoristic nugget that's supposed to describe and inform what the academy's philosophy is all about. After Mario's father, Dr. Incandenza, passed away, the new headmaster, Dr. Charles Tavis, a Canadian citizen, either Mrs. Incandenza's half-brother or adoptive brother, depending on the version, C.T., had taken down Incandenza's founding motto, Te occidere possunt, sed te edere non possunt, nefas est, and had replaced it with the rather more upbeat, the man who knows his limitations has none.
32.
Mario is an enormous fan of Gerhard Stitt, who most of the other ETA kids regard as probably bats, and as, without doubt, mind loosening discursive, and show the old pundit even token respect mostly because Stitt still personally oversees the daily drill assignments and can, if aggrieved, have Thode and DeLint make them extremely uncomfortable, more or less at will, out there in AM practice. One of the reasons the late James Incandenza had been so terribly high on bringing Stitt to ETA was that Stitt, like the founder himself, who'd come back to tennis and later film, from a background in hardcore, math-based optical science, was that Stitt approached competitive tennis more like a pure mathematician than a technician. Most junior tennis coaches are basically technicians, Hands-on, practical, straight-ahead, problem-solving, statistical data wonks. With maybe added knacks for short-haul psychology and motivational speaking. The point about not crunching serious stats is that Stitt had clued in Candenza in all the way back at a BS 1989 USTA convention on photoelectric line judging that he, Stitt, knew real tennis was really about not the blend of statistical order and expansive potential that the game's technicians revered, but in fact the opposite. Not order. Limit. The places where things broke down, fragmented into beauty.
33.
That real tennis was no more reducible to delimited factors or probability curves than chess or boxing, the two games of which it's a hybrid. In short, Stitt and the tall AEC optics man, i.e., in Candenza, whose fierce, flat, serve and haul ass to the net approach to the game had carried him through MIT on a full ride with stipend, and whose consulting report on high-speed photoelectric tracking the USTA mucky-mucks found dense past all comprehending, found themselves totally simpatico on tennis's exemption from stats tracking regression. Were he now still among the living, Dr. Incandenza would now describe tennis in the paradoxical terms of what's now called extra-linear dynamics.
34.
And Stitt, whose knowledge of formal math is probably about equivalent to that of a Taiwanese kindergartner, nevertheless seemed to know what Hopman and Vandermeer and Bolitari seemed not to know. That locating beauty and art and magic and improvement and keys to excellence and victory in the prolix flux of match play is not a fractal matter of reducing chaos to pattern. Seemed intuitively to sense that it was a matter not of reduction at all, but, perversely, of expansion, the aleatory flutter of uncontrolled, metastatic growth. Each well-shot ball admitting of N possible responses, N to the second power possible responses to those responses, and on into what Incandenza would articulate to anyone who shared both his backgrounds as a Cantorian continuum of infinities of possible move and response. Cantorian and beautiful because infoliating contained this diagonal infinity of infinities of choice and execution, mathematically uncontrolled but humanly contained, bounded by the talent and imagination of self and opponent, bent in on itself by the containing boundaries of skill and imagination that brought one player finally down, that kept both from winning, that made it finally a game. These boundaries of self.
35.
You mean like the baselines are boundaries? Mario tries to ask.
Lieber Gott, nein!
With a plosive, disgusted sound. Stitt likes best of all smoke shapes to try to blow rings, and is kind of lousy at it, blowing mostly wobbly lavender hot dogs, which Mario finds delightful. The thing with Stitt, like most Europeans of his generation, anchored from infancy to certain permanent values which, yes, okay, granted, may admittedly have a whiff of proto-fascist potential about them, but which do, nevertheless, the values, anchor nicely the soul and course of a life. Old world, patriarchal stuff like honor and discipline and fidelity to some larger unit, Gerhard Stitt does not so much dislike the modern O-N-A-N-ite U.S. of A. as find it hilarious and frightening at the same time. Probably, mostly just alien. This should not be rendered in exposition like this, but Mario Incandenza has a severely limited range of verbatim recall. Stitt was educated in pre-unification gymnasium, under the rather Canto-Hegelian idea that junior athletics was basically just training for citizenship, that junior athletics was about learning to sacrifice the hot, narrow imperatives of the self, the needs, the desires, the fears, the multiform cravings of the individual appetitive will, to the larger imperatives of a team. Okay. The state, and a set of delimiting rules. Okay, the law. It sounds almost frighteningly simple-minded, though not to Mario, across the redwood table, listening. By learning, In Palestra, the virtues that pay off directly in competitive games, the well-disciplined boy begins assembling the more abstract, gratification-delaying skills necessary for being a team player in a larger arena, the even more subtly diffracted moral chaos of full-service citizenship in a state. Except Stitt says, ach, but who can imagine this training serving its purpose in an experialist and waste-exporting nation that's forgotten privation and hardship and the discipline which hardship teaches by requiring? A U.S. of modern A, where the state is not a team or a code, but a sort of sloppy intersection of desires and fears, where the only public consensus a boy must surrender to is the acknowledged primacy of straight line pursuing this flat and short-sighted idea of personal happiness.
The happy pleasure of the person alone, yes?
Except why do you let DeLint tie Pemulus and Shaw's shoes to the lines, if the lines aren't boundaries?
Without there is something bigger. Nothing to contain and give the meaning. Lonely. Verstiegenheit.
36.
Bless you.
Any something. The what? This is more unimportant than that there is something.
Stitt one time was telling Mario, as they respectively walked and tottered down Commonwealth Avenue eastward into Alston to see about getting a gourmet ice cream someplace along there, that when he was Mario's age, or maybe more like Hal's age, whatever, he, Stitt, had once fallen in love with a tree. A willow that, from a certain humid twilight perspective, had looked like a mysterious woman aswirl with gauze. This certain tree, in the public plots of some West German town whose name sounded to Mario like the sound of somebody strangling. Stitt reported being seriously smitten with the tree.
I went daily to there, to be with the tree.
They respectively walked and tottered, ice cream bound, Mario moving like the one of them who was truly old, mind off his stride because he was trying to think hard about what Stitt believed. Mario's thinking hard expression resembles what, for another person, would be the sort of comically distorted face made to amuse an infant. He was trying to think how to articulate some reasonable form of a question like, but then how does this surrender the personal, individual wants to the larger state or beloved tree or something stuff work in a deliberately individual sport like competitive junior tennis, where it's just you versus one other guy? And then also, again, still, what are those boundaries if they're not baselines that contain and direct its infinite expansion inward, that make tennis like chess on the run, beautiful and infinitely dense? Stitt's thrust, and his one great irresistible attraction in the eyes of Mario's late father, the true opponent, the enfolding boundary, is the player himself. Always and only the self out there, on court, to be met, fought, brought to the table to hammer out terms. The competing boy on the net's other side, he is not the foe. He is more the partner in the dance. He is the, what is the word, excuse or occasion for meeting the self, as you are his occasion. Tennis's beauty's infinite roots are self-competitive. You compete with your own limits to transcend the self in imagination and execution. Disappear inside the game. Break through limits. Transcend. Improve. Win. Which is why tennis is an essentially tragic enterprise, to improve and grow as a serious junior with ambitions. You seek to vanquish and transcend the limited self whose limits make the game possible in the first place. It is tragic and sad and chaotic and lovely. All life is the same, as citizens of the human state. The animating limits are within, to be killed and mourned over and over again. Mario thinks of a steel pole, raised to double its designed height, and clips his shoulder on the green steel edge of a dumpster, pirouetting halfway to the cement before Stitt darts in to catch him. And it almost looks like they're doing a dance floor dip As Stitt says, this game, the players, are all at ETA to learn. This infinite system of decisions and angles and lines Mario's brothers worked so brutishly hard to master. Junior athletics is but one facet of the real gem. Life's endless war against the self you cannot live without. Stitt then falls into the sort of silence of someone who's enjoying mentally rewinding and replaying what he just came up with. Mario thinks hard again. He's trying to think of how to articulate something like, but then is battling and vanquishing the self the same as destroying yourself? Is that like saying life is pro-death? Three passing Alstonian street kids mock and make fun of Mario's appearance behind the pair's backs. Some of Mario's thinking faces are almost orgasmic, fluttery and slack. And then, but so, what's the difference between tennis and suicide, life and death, the game and its own end? It's always Stitt who ends up experimenting with some exotic ice cream flavor when they arrive. Mario always chickens out and opts for good old basic chocolate when the moment of decision at the counter comes. Thinking along the lines of, like, better the flavor you know for sure you already love.
And so, no different, maybe, Stitt concedes,
sitting up straight on a waffle-seated aluminum chair, with Mario beneath an askew umbrella that makes the flimsy little table it's rooted to shake and clank in the sidewalk's breeze.
Maybe no different, so,
biting hard into his tricolored cone. He feels at the side of his white jaw where there's some sort of red welt, it looks like.
Not different.
Looking out into the avenue's raised median at the Green Line train rattling past downhill.
Accept the chance to play.
He brightens in preparation to laugh in his startling German roar, saying,
no? Yes? The chance to play. Yes?
And Mario loses a dollop of chocolate down his chin because he has this involuntary thing where he laughs whenever anyone else does, and Stitt is finding what he has just said very amusing indeed. Year of the Depend, Adult Undergarment. There is no jolly irony in Tiny Ewell's name. He is tiny, an elf-sized U.S. male. His feet barely reach the floor of the taxi. He is seated, being driven east into the grim three-decker districts of East Watertown, west of Boston proper. A rehabilitative staffer wearing custodial whites under a bombardier's jacket sits beside Tiny Ewell, big arms crossed and staring placid as a cow at the intricately creased back of the cabbie's neck. The window Tiny is next to has a sticker that thanks him in advance for not smoking. Tiny Ewell wears no winter gear over a jacket and tie that don't quite go together and stares out his window with unplacid intensity at the same district he grew up in. He normally takes involved routes to avoid Watertown. His jacket, a 26 small. His slacks, a 26-24. His shirt, one of the shirts his wife had so considerately packed for him to bring into the hospital detox and hang on hangers that won't leave the rod. As with all Tiny Ewell's business shirts, only the front and cuffs are ironed. He wears size 6 Florsheim wingtips that gleam nicely except for one big, incongruous scuff mark of white from where he'd kicked at his front door when he'd returned home just before dawn from an extremely important get-together with potential clients to find that his wife had had the locks changed and filed a restraining order and would communicate with him only by notes passed through the mail slot below the white door's black brass. The brass had been painted black. Knocker. When Tiny leans down and wipes at the scuff mark with a slim thumb, it only pales and smears. It is Tiny's first time out of happy slippers since his second day at the detox. They took away his Florsheims after 24 abstinent hours had passed, and he started to perhaps DT a little. He'd kept noticing mice scurrying around his room. Mice as in rodents, vermin. And when he lodged a complaint and demanded the room be fumigated at once and then began running around, hunched and pounding with the heel of a handheld Florsheim at the mice, as they continued to ooze through the room's electrical outlets and scurry repulsively about. Eventually, a gentle-faced nurse, flanked by large men in custodial whites, negotiated a trade of shoes for Librium, predicting that the mild sedative would fumigate what really needed to be fumigated. They gave him slippers of green foam rubber with smiley faces embossed on the tops. The detox's inpatients are encouraged to call these happy slippers. The staff referred to the footwear in private as piss catchers. It is Tiny Ewell's first day out of rubber slippers and ass-exposing detox pajamas and striped cotton robe in 2 weeks. The early November day is foggy and colorless. The sky and the street are the same color. The trees look skeletal. There is bright, wet, wadded litter all along the seams of street and curb. The houses are skinny three-deckers, mashed together, wharf gray with salt-white trim, Madonnas in the yards, bow-legged dogs hurling themselves against the fencing. Some schoolboys in knee pads and scally caps are playing street hockey on a passing school cement playground, except none of the boys seems to be moving. The trees' bony fingers make spell-casting gestures in the wind as they pass. East Watertown is the obvious straight-line easement between St. Mel's Detox and the halfway house's Enfield, and Ewell's insurance is paying for the cab. With his small round shape and bit of white goatee and a violent flush that could pass for health of some jolly sort, Tiny Ewell looks like a radically downscaled Burl Ives. The late Burl Ives as an impossible, bearded child. Tiny looks out the window at the rose window of the church next to the school playground, where the boys are playing slash not playing. The rose window is not illuminated from either side. The man who, for the last 3 days, has been Tiny Ewell's roommate at St. Mel's Hospital's detoxification unit, sits in a blue plastic straight-back chair in front of his and Ewell's room's Windows air conditioner, watching it. The air conditioner hums and gushes, and the man gazes with rapt intensity into its screen of horizontal vents. The air conditioner's cord is thick and white and leads into a three-prong outlet with black heel marks on the wall all around it. The November room is around 12 degrees centigrade. The man turns the air conditioner's dial from setting number 4 to setting number 5. The curtains above it shake and billow around the window. The man's face falls into and out of amused expressions as he watches the air conditioner. He sits in the blue chair with a trembling styrofoam cup of coffee and a paper plate of brownies into which he taps ashes from the cigarettes whose smoke the air conditioner blows straight back over his head. The cigarette smoke is starting to pile up against the wall behind him, and to ooze and run chilled down the wall and form a sort of cloud bank near the floor. The man's raptly amused profile appears in the mirror on the wall beside the dresser the two inpatients share. The man, like Tiny Ewell, has the rouged corpse look that attends detox from late-stage alcoholism. The man is, in addition, a burnt yellow beneath his flush from chronic hepatitis. The mirror he appears in is treated with shatterproof Lucite polymers. The man leans carefully forward with the plate of brownies in his lap and changes the setting on the air conditioner from 5 to 3, and then to 7, then 8, scanning the screen of gushing vents. He finally turns the selector's dial all the way around to 9. The air conditioner roars and blows his long hair straight back, and his beard blows back over his shoulder. Ashes fly and swirl around from his plate of brownies, plus crumbs, and his Rodney's tip glows cherry and gives sparks. He is deeply engaged by whatever he sees on 9. He gives Tiny Ewell the screaming memes, Ewell has complained. He wears piss catchers, a striped cotton St. Mel's robe, and a pair of glasses missing one lens. He has been watching the air conditioner all day. His face produces the little smiles and grimaces of a person who's being thoroughly entertained. When the big black rehabilitative staffer placed Tiny Yule in the taxi and then squeezed in and told the cabbie they wanted Unit Number 6 in the Enfield Marine VA Hospital Complex just off Commonwealth Avenue in Enfield, the cabbie, whose photo was on the Massachusetts livery license taped to the glove compartment, the cabbie looking back and down at little Tiny Yule's neat white beard and ruddy complexion and sharp threads, had scratched under his scally cap and asked if he was sick or something. Tiny Yule had said, "So it would seem." By mid-afternoon on the 2nd of April, YDAU, the Near Eastern medical attaché, his devout wife, the Saudi Prince Q's personal physician's personal assistant, who'd been sent over to see why the medical attaché hadn't appeared at the Back Bay Hilton in the AM, and then hadn't answered his beeper's page. The personal physician himself, who'd come to see why his personal assistant hadn't come back. Two embassy security guards with sidearms, who'd been dispatched by a candidiatic, heartily pissed off Prince Q, and two neatly groomed Seventh-day Adventist pamphleteers who'd seen human heads through the living room window and found the front door unlocked and come in with all good spiritual intentions. All were watching the recursive loop the medical attaché had rigged on the TP's viewer the night before, sitting and standing there very still and attentive, looking not one bit distressed or in any way displeased, even though the room smelled very bad indeed. The 30th of April, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. He sat alone above the desert, redly backlit and framed in shale, watching very yellow payloaders crawl over the beaten dirt of some USA construction site several kilometers to the southeast. The outcropping's height allowed him, Marat, to look out over most of USA, area code 6026. His shadow did not yet reach the downtown regions of the city of Tucson. Not yet quite. Of sounds in the air at hush were only a faint and occasional hot wind, the blurred sound of the wings of sometimes an insect, some tentative trickling of loosened grit and small stones moving farther down the upslope behind, and as well the sunset over the foothills and mountains behind him. Such a difference from the watery and somehow sad spring sunsets of southwestern Quebec's Papineau regions, where his wife had need of care. This, the sunset, more resembled an explosion. It took place above and behind him, and he turned some of the time to regard it. It, the sunset, was swollen and perfectly round and large, radiating knives of light when he squinted. It hung and trembled slightly like a viscous drop about to fall. It hung just above the peaks of the Tortolita foothills behind him, Marat, and slowly was sinking. Marat sat alone and blanket-lapped in his customized fauteuil de Roland on a kind of outcropping or shelf about halfway up, waiting, amusing himself with his shadow.
37.
As the lowering light from behind came at an angle more and more acute, Goethe's well-known Brockengespenst phenomenon enlarged and distended his seated shadow far out over land, so that the spokes of his chair's rear wheels cast over two whole counties below gigantic asterisk shadows, whose fine black radial lines he could cause to move by playing slightly with the wheel's rubber rims, and his head's shadow brought to much of the suburb West Tucson a premature dusk.
38.
He appeared to remain concentrated on his huge shadow play as gravel, and then also breath, sounded from the steep hillside back above him, grit and dirty stones cascading onto the outcropping and gushing past his chair and off the front lip, and then the unmistakable yelp of an individual's impact with a cactus somewhere up behind. But Marat, he had all the time without turning watched the other man's clumsy sliding descent's own mammoth shadow, cast as far east as the Rincon Range just past the city Tucson, I could see the shadow rush in west toward his own, as unspecified services M. Hugh Steeply descended, falling twice and cursing in USA English, until the shadow collapsed nearly into Marat's monstrous own. Another yelp took place as the unspecified services field operatives fall and slide, the last several meters carried him upon his bottom, down onto the outcropping, and then nearly all the way out and off it, Marat having to release the machine pistol under his blanket to grab Steeply's bare arm and halt this sliding. Steeply's skirt was pulled obscenely up and his hosiery full of runs and stubs of thorns. The operative sat at Marat's feet, glowing redly in the backlight, legs hanging over the shelf's edge, breathing with difficulty. Marat smiled and released the operative's arm.
"Stealth becomes you," he said.
"Go shit in your chapeau,"
Steeply wheezed, bringing up his legs to survey the hosiery's damage. They spoke, for the most part, USA English when they met like this, covertly in the field. Monsieur Fautier had wished Marat to require that they interface always in Quebecois French, as for a small symbolic concession to the AFR on the part of the Office of Unspecified Services, which the Quebecois separatist left referred to always as BSS, the Bureau des Services sans Spécificité.
39.
Marat watched a column of shadow spread again out east over the desert's floor as Steeply got a hand under himself and rose, a huge and well-fed figure, tottering on heels. The two men sent together a strange, brockengespenst shadow out toward the city Tucson, a shadow round and radial at the base and jagged at the top, from Steeply's wig becoming uncombed in his descent. Steeply's gigantic prosthetic breasts pointed in wildly different directions now, one nearly at the empty sky. The matte curtain of sunset's true dusk shadow was moving itself very slowly in across the Rincons and Sonora Desert east of the city Tucson, still many kilometers from obscuring their own large shadow. But once Marat had committed not just to pretend to betray his Alsacien de fauteuil roulant in order to secure advanced medical care for the medical needs of his wife, but to, in truth, do this, betray, perfidiously, now pretending only to Monsieur Fautier and his AFR superiors that he was merely pretending to feed some betraying information to BSS. Once this decision, Marat was without all power, served now at the pleasures of the power of Steeply and the BSS of Hugh Steeply. And now they spoke mostly the USA English of Steeply's preference.
40.
In fact, Steeply's Quebecois was better than Marat's English. But c'était la guerre, as one says. Marat sniffed slightly.
"That's so. We now are both here."
He wore a windbreaker and did not perspire. Steeply's eyes were luridly made up. The rear area of his dress was dirty. Some of his makeup had started to run. He was forming a type of salute to shade his eyes and looking upward behind them at what remained of the explosive and trembling sun.
"How in God's name did you get up here?"
Marat slowly shrugged. As usual, he appeared to Steeply as if he were half asleep. He ignored the question and said only, shrugging,
"My time is finite."
Steeply had also with him a woman's handbag or purse.
"And the wife?" he said, gazing upward as yet. "How's the wife doing?"
"Holding her own weight, thank you,"
Marat said. His tone of his voice betrayed nothing.
"And so thus, what is it your officers believe they wish to know?"
Steeply tottered on a leg as he removed one shoe and poured from it grit.
"Nothing terribly surprising. A bit of razzle-dazzle up northeast in your so-called ops area. Certainly you heard."
Marat sniffed. A large odor of inexpensive and high-alcohol perfume came not from Steeply's person, but from his handbag, which failed to complement his shoes. Marat said, "Dazelle?"
"As in a civilian-type individual receives a certain item. Don't tell me this is news to you guys. Not on interlaced pulse, this item. Arrives via normal physical mail. We're sure you heard, Raimi. A cartridge copy of a certain, let's call it, between ourselves, the entertainment.
As in the mail, without warning or motive, out of the blue?
From somewhere blue?
The BSS operative had perspired also through his rouge, and his mascara had melted to become whorish.
A person with no political value to anybody except that the Saudi Ministry of Entertainment made one hell of a shrill stink.
The medical attaché, the specialist of digesting you refer to.
Marat shrugged again, in that maddening francophone way that can mean several things.
Your offices wish to ask, was the entertainment cartridge disseminated through our mechanisms?
Don't let's waste your finite time, Ami old friend, Steeply said. The mischief happens to occur in metropolitan Boston. Postal codes route the package through the desert southwest, and we know your dissemination scheme's routing mechanism is proposed for somewhere between Phoenix and the border down here.
Steeply had worked hard at feminizing his expressions and gesturing.
It will be a bit starry-eyed of OUS not to think of your distinguished cell, no?
Beneath Marat's windbreaker was a sport shirt whose breast pocket was filled with many pens. He said,
Us, we don't have the information on even casualties. From this blue dazzle you speak of.
Steeply was trying to extract something stubborn from inside his other shoe.
Upwards of 20, Raimi. Out of commission, altogether. The attaché and his wife, the wife a Saudi citizen. 4 more raggers, all with embassy cards. Couple neighbors or something. The rest mostly police before word got to a level they could stop police from going in before they killed the power.
Local police forces? Or gendarme?
The local constabulary.
The minions of the law of the land.
The local constabulary were, shall we say, unprepared for an entertainment like this.
Steeply even removed and replaced his pumps in the upright, on one leg bringing other foot up behind his bottom way of a feminine USA woman. But he appeared huge and bloated as a woman. Not merely unattractive, but inducing something like sexual despair, he said,
The attaché had diplomatic status, Raimi. Mideast, Saudi. Said to be close to minor members of the royal family.
Marat sniffed hard, as if congested of the nose.
A puzzling, he said.
But also a compatriot of yours. Canadian citizenship. Born in Ottawa. To Arab emigres. Visa lists a residence in Montreal.
On services without specificity, wishes maybe to ask, were there below-the-surface connections that make the individual not such a civilian? Unconnected? To ask of us, would the AFR wish to make of him the example?
Steeply was removing dirt from his bottom, swatting himself on the bottom. He stood more or less directly over Marat. Marat sniffed.
We have neither digestive medicals, nor diplomatic entourages on any list for action. You have personally seen AFR's initial lists, nor in particular Montreal civilians. We have, as one will say, a larger seafood to cook.
Steeply was looking out over the desert and city also, as he swatted at himself. He seemed to have noticed the gespenst phenomenon of his own shadow. Marat, for some reason, pretended again to sniff the nose. The wind was moderate and constant, and of about the temperature of a USA clothes dryer set on low. It made the shrill whistling sounds. Also sounds of the blowing grit. Weeds of tumbling, like enormous hairballs, rolled often across the interstate highway of I-10 far below. Their specular perspective, the reddening light on vast tan stone, and the oncoming curtain of dusk, the further elongation of their monstrous agnate shadows, all was almost mesmerizing. Neither man seemed able to look at anything but the vista below. Marat could simultaneously speak in English and think in French. The desert was the tawny color of the hide of the lion. They're speaking without looking at one another, facing both the same direction. This gave their conversing an air of careless intimacy, as of old friends at the cartridge viewer together, or a long-married couple. Murat thought this as he opened and closed his upheld hand, making over the city Tucson a huge and black blossom open itself and close itself. And steeply raised his bare arms and held them out.